Yesterday, I was at the Robinson Nature Center for the first time. My family had gone, but this was my first chance to do so. And we went inside, and there were those cutouts that kids can stand in. You just see their heads. And I took some pictures and was excited. And then, as you can tell from having seen my son this morning, he's easily distractible. And somebody just happened to be walking by and said the word snack. And even though he had already had snack, he had to have snack again. And so I was quickly rumbling through some veggie chips and trying to get him fed. And then we tried to transition into a room where they were having sea creatures that you can go and touch ever so gently so that you don't disrupt their habitat. And as we did this, I was feeling such a pause of relief and a sigh after several weeks of illness that we could just be out in the world, taking in God's beauty, taking in nature. For as we had walked up to the Nature Center, I don't know if you've ever been there, but it is, you can tell it's beautiful even in a season like this when it's so very bare. My husband had said, we've got to come back in the spring. And I thought, yes, but I'm glad I'm here today. Because somehow what I'm seeing outside along this stretch mirrors some of what's going on the inside. Some of what I tend to feel in the wintertime, and especially when there's been a string of things that feel like they have kept you back. It's important to see out there volunteers, as we did, with their shears going at each of the branches that needed to be cut away from that beautiful vegetation. And Phoebe didn't know what that was about, so I had to explain what pruning is. When you go in and you find the overgrowth and the dead branches and you clip them away, why do we clip them away? Because we have to make way for new growth in order for that to happen. And the unfortunate thing in that immediate sense of the demand of a child's world of happening now, it's hard to explain that the vegetation is going to take time. And that there are seasons in which we have to trust that after we've done the clipping and attended to the Spirit's call to take away that which we don't need anymore, that at that point we can expect that already from the inside, from the rootedness, from inside that plant itself, perhaps from inside of us, that there are already things being watered, ready to begin to take on new life. Lent isn't here yet, but it's coming in a week and a half. And perhaps this is part of a preparation for that experience. And part of that preparation comes in the forgiveness story here that we have from Joseph. It was particularly on my mind this week. I have to say that my world and my Facebook page, if those of you who are on Facebook and know what it's like to see what everybody's talking about out there, I have a disproportionate number of Methodist friends. In part because I'm a lifelong United Methodist, in part because I am a United Methodist pastor, and in part because there is a crazy conference that is happening in St. Louis right now. It's made the national news, and I might see Matt sigh deeply over there because he also lives with a United Methodist pastor. And it's with great exasperation that many of us come to this, a great amount of heartache. Some of us carry about of shame. There's also hope mixed in there. Because yet again, what is being discussed is LGBTQ inclusion. And many of us are on a side in which we cannot believe that we have not manifested as church in such a way that love is just manifest itself. And there's still exclusionary language that people are confronted with as they look through the codes and the discipline of our structure and the denomination. What makes this particularly heartbreaking at this point is because it's taken so long to get here to have this conversation, and there's still people that don't believe that that should be the case. And claiming a certain level of biblical authority by which they would seek to break with others who feel like inclusion is the route in which the living out of Christ would call us to be with all people. And so I have pastored at a church for 7 years, where there was a differing of opinion on a long spectrum, and we have been a big Methodist tent by which we want everyone to feel like they feel, for people to hold different viewpoints. But for some of us, at the crossroads of social justice, this is a continually unacceptable juncture to be in, especially when I sit at covenant table, as I did this past week with my friends, two of whom are gay, and they lament and weep again, because this church has continually allowed space for them in some places, and in others said, you are not good enough. And again, there is a conference that would seek to dissect a portion of their integrity in the call that they have to ordain ministry, even as one still is held in the wings waiting to see what comes out of St. Louis. Yet again, we sat down and we lamented together. Some would be going to St. Louis, and our prayers were going with them as we seek to try and understand how we're still here and still find love in our hearts for those who would have differing opinions than we do. Perhaps this is true in your own journey and story as you think about your neighbors or those that you share a driveway with. Thinking about those who would have different ways of understanding who's in and who's out. And gosh, it's a lot easier when you're talking one-on-one to enfold and embrace that person. But in our dialogues and our social cultural spaces, aren't we quick to be divisive? And that cancer is true in my denomination, the United Methodist Church, of which I was a part before I was even conceived. It was something I was born into. It's been important in the last couple of weeks. There's been a group of us. I keep looking at John and others who have been a part of the Call to Commitment class, by which we've been studying the Elizabeth O'Connor book that was a formational text narrating the Church of the Savior's life in the beginning. It takes place in 1963, and what's so striking about it, especially perhaps as we put on our 50th anniversary goggles and glasses, visionary tools by which we can zero in on where God might yet have us be, is looking at the willingness of that church to continually restructure itself, to continue to know that it, as a non-denominational ecumenical plant that exists on the plains of our world, that it knows that in each evolution in time, with each year perhaps, especially each generation, that there are new needs that are there. And there's an evolving sense of how to catch up with Jesus, who is meandering through these roads looking for the unclean and the unkempt and those who would otherwise be cast off, and trying to touch his garment and say, will some of your inclusivity rub off on me? Will some of who you are and the radical nature of your love penetrate my very being, that I could indeed be the church in this day and in this place? I think the Church of the Savior folks saw the ways in which the institution was more slow to move in order to catch up with this radical nature of love. And that's what made some of the Church of the Savior unique in its willingness to ongoingly ask itself those questions, to fail when it needed to fail, but to be on the street meeting those who were in most in need of that message, not because it was always, let me read from the Bible for you, but let me pour you a cup of coffee. And let's sit down and let's have those one-on-one conversations by which I bring that born into-ness that I have, and you bring whatever baggage it is that you have, and we meet in that broken space. It is in that deeply broken space that we might prune together away the preconceptions and the false assumptions that we bring, and see in each other's eyes the beautiful and beloved nature of God, God's self. And that's what I want to believe when I sit in a covenant group with my gay pastor friends. And it is their very existence that has kept my very existence in the denomination. For I say, if they and all that they bring, despite the desire for dissecting who they are, if they are willing to make space and help revolutionize the denomination from the inside out, how can I leave and leave them behind to do the work, the inner work of God's, Jesus's radical love? And I guess the question is, if there's still life in a shriveled plant. That's what we're asking us, we United Methodists. Can God still find a way of nourishing what remains? Will people remain? What dialogue will come in the next 3 days? What policy? What procedure? Who will be here? Who will be there? Who will be in? Who will be out? I don't know. And let's please send our mercies to all of the pastors out there this morning having to preach in United Methodist congregations, trying to interpret a message of that which we don't know that will be decided on Tuesday and Wednesday, and trying to assure their people that love still is abounding in this shrivelly plant. I know that pruning is in order. I don't know what that pruning will look like. But I know that I'm here with you, and I believe in grace, and I believe in this beautiful new definition I've gotten from John Owens that came from Gordon Cosby, and I'm going to see if I can get it without looking. A gift, unmerited and undeserved, coming at just the right time. I believe that part of my call to you was just that. Grace. Not because I deserved it, although you helped me to outline all of the reasons I should be here. All the schooling and all the good things. Not because it was merited, especially this call unto ordained life. But it came at the right time in the season of my life and my family's life, perhaps as we struggle within the Methodist Church, but also as we vision and wonder aloud about what church can and will be with such excitement, an excitement that I think I see in you, and I see it matches some of the excitement that you carry, this grace that you hold, that time and time again, from our 1969 reality until today, is unfolding. Not because we can prescribe it, and not because we have exact dogma. We're pretty proud on not having that. But because we open our hearts and we trim away at that which we know is holding us back. And we're attentive to the Spirit in such a way that grace can come, and no matter what, it can surprise us. In Joseph's story of forgiveness, there's this build up to this dramatic moment in which the brothers don't know his identity. They don't know how very much they can be the recipients of something so deep as to have come from the same line of Jacob. And they, in their desperation and their biggest moment of need, they have no idea. They think they are asking for crumbs or the mercy of a stranger in a strange land. And they come to find out that the stranger in the strange land is their very own kin. The remnant people have been on a move and have found themselves. And so in that glorious moment, somehow, Joseph finds it within himself. Perhaps it's all of the broken work that he had done in the pit. Perhaps it was the false accusations that landed him in prison. Perhaps it was the hard dream work that he had done to interpret the life of the land for the people. But now it is not revenge. Revenge could be his dogma. But it is something that takes him to the utter edge of who he is, all he can give, all of the weeping that would come forth from him. And it's then that God takes him and takes them and elevates them with a gift that they can't even imagine that they would have needed. A gift. I feel in some ways that some of my LGBTQ brothers and sisters and others, and that they are in a Joseph position because day in, day out, they've been having Joseph days by which in the vulnerability of their kinsfolk, they cry out and say, "Don't you see the abundance that is here and the scarcity of which you come from? Don't you see that time and time again I'm revealing who I am before you in all of its mystery and beauty? Don't you see what it takes for me to be fully who God has called me to be? Don't you see?" Will you weep with me the tears that can be at the root of new possibility? Will you prune with me the things that speak of hatred? Can we be together once again in this denomination or in this world in which we so need God's love? Can you cry with me? And so those are the tears that I combine with my friends. For I do not know what is coming. But this God of Joseph means that I have to find space in my heart for a grace that I yet cannot conceive. And that's the prayer I invite you into today for this denomination that is so wrapped up in me. I want to just share lastly that, remember when I was talking about snacks and I was talking about the cutouts and taking pictures and walking into sea urchins and the beautiful mystery of all of that? As I came out of that room after we had touched the sea urchins, and I walked past a woman who was smiling on a bench, and I just smiled back at her, and I started to walk away, and she said, "Excuse me." And I said, "Yes." And she said, "Is this your phone?" I had been reaching for snacks. I had just taken the picture, and there on the bench, I must have left my phone, but I didn't know it yet. But I think it was grace that was the gift that saved me from some of that anxiety and helped me be in touch with the vulnerability that a stranger can extend to you with their life, my life, in their hands. May grace be like that for us as we vision forward. And I pray prayer upon prayer that grace might be that for my friends, for my denomination, and for the church universal.